Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another great episode we have here of Suspense Radio. I'm your host, John Robb. Today, we have a powerhouse lineup, one that we haven't seen in quite some time, if ever. First off, we're going to have New York Times bestselling author Steve Barry, better known for his Cotton Malone series, but he wrote a book called The Columbus Affair that's not Cotton Malone, something a little bit different that we're going to get into. Then we're going to have author Nick Santora, who you might know from the writer, one of the main writers on Prison Break, also The Sopranos, Law and Order, the show creator of Breakout Kings, and he wrote his book, 15 Digits. And we're going to end it off with author Paul Kempercoes, who's better known for writing with Clive Cussler and the Numa Files. He's going to talk about his creations that he did outside all of that, bringing them over to ebook form and the whole stuff. So we got a lot of fun things going on, and it all is going to start on Suspense Radio 90 Minutes. Right now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong.
I'd like to welcome again, everybody, to Suspense Radio. I'm your host, John Robb, and we are going to jump right in here with our first guest. Like I said, New York Times bestselling author of the Cotton Malone series. Recently, his book comes out on Tuesday called The Columbus Affair, which is going to introduce a new character that Steve has written, and his name is Tom Sagan. And Steve, we would like to welcome you so much to the show again. How are you doing?
Doing great. Great to be back.
So, again, Cotton Malone talked to you about a little while ago and said, Steve, look, I need a break. I got to take it easy. You gotta just let me lay low for a little while. So you said, no problem. You decided to go ahead and bring out a new character who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, Tom Sagan, but has a lot of baggage or demons that he has to bring forward with him into this latest book, The Columbus Affair. Very complex character you created with Tom. How was the creation of that? Kind of get away from Cotton Malone to be able to create this character, Tom?
Well, he's a totally different kind of guy than Cotton. He's not a super agent. He doesn't have those kinds of skills. He's a journalist, but he's a disgraced journalist. He's been ruined, and his entire career has been destroyed, and he's at the end of his rope. In fact, he's about to kill himself. He's within 1 second of pulling the trigger when something happens. And when that happens, he gets thrown into this great adventure dealing with Christopher Columbus. And I wanted to create a flawed character. They needed to have that, but I also wanted him, to have some ability to get himself in and out of trouble in ways different than Cotton, and he does that. I really enjoyed Tom. He changes a lot as the book goes on. He has a lot of experiences that happen to him over the course of this novel, and I'd love to come back and visit him again one day.
Yeah, like I kind of mentioned to you off the air with this new book, The Columbus Affair, and remind everybody, it comes out on Tuesday. Go to steveberry.org, and you'll see the countdown coming up with a lot of other great things that Steve has going on that you can explore his website, one of the most complex websites that an author can have. But when you're looking here at, Tom, and you decided to go ahead and do all of these things, Christopher Columbus is one of those characters that a lot of people know of. Of course, they know his name. We have a holiday for him in October, and he discovered America. But you went above and beyond to understand the man, Christopher Columbus, like you always do with your history and everything that you wrote. And like I said, I think that this book, you know, Cotton Malone with Tom Sagan, you gave him a run for his money, Cotton, on this one. I mean, this is one of, this is an excellent book.
I appreciate that very much. Christopher Columbus is fascinating because we don't know anything about this guy. I mean, we know zero. All that stuff you learned in school, all that stuff you taught and all, none of it's true. We don't know
right.
where he was born. We don't know who his parents were. We don't know how he was educated. He was an expert seaman, but we have no idea how he became that. We don't know what he looked like. We don't know how he made his way to the New World. The chart he used disappeared during his time. We don't know what happened when he got there because the Journal of Columbus that we all read is a copy of a copy. So there's no way to know if it's even possible to be correct. And then there's an interesting theory with Columbus, a great mystery associated with him, a new explanation about Columbus that I stumbled across a few years ago in a nonfiction book I found. And when I read it, I said, there's a novel in that. And this secret of Columbus that's becoming more and more possible is what forms the basis of the novel.
And that's the one thing that you do. I mean, there's a lot of historical writers, they write historical fiction, and they take, you know, those articles, and they take things that, you know, whatever it could be, or it could be any kind of thing that was back in history. But there's a sense that you just know that it's fiction. But with your books, when you're writing, you always get the sense that everything in there is a believability, and you do something really great at the end. Of course, you say, this part was real, this part was, you know, what you added to the book to make up. But throughout the book, you get the sense that everything, I mean, the believability of, you know, Christopher Columbus alone is a mystery, and it's like you just said, within itself. So not only do you have that aspect, but that everything else that you kind of put along with it. Was this one of the most difficult books because of the fact of, you're talking 1492, you know, Sailed the Ocean Blue, there's just not a lot of things out there for him, you know, for you to discover about him.
Well, the problem is that the stuff out there all conflicts with one another. I read about 300 books on Christopher Columbus, and when you do that,
oh my Lord, 300.
Yeah, you will see just how incredible the stories vary. I mean, they're all different. Every single account of his life and his history is all different. And the fact of the matter is we know nothing. We don't know. We have no clue. And Columbus himself created this mystery during his own lifetime because he rarely talked of himself. He almost never wrote about himself. And when he did, he usually contradicted himself. Now, give the listeners I don't want to give away too much of the book because it's really an interesting secret. But I will give them a couple of things that will kind of tantalize a little bit. When Columbus sailed, he sailed on the night of August 2nd, 1492. That's when he left Spain. Now, he was in a great hurry to get out of there, and he left very quickly in the night. Coincidentally, on August 3rd, 1492, which was at midnight that night, it would have been illegal for any Jews to be in Spain. They had all been expelled from Spain 6 months earlier and given to that day to be gone. Now, aboard his three ships, he has 87 men. Contrary to Hollywood, not a single priest is among any of those 87 men. But there was on board a Hebrew translator. Now, why did he need a Hebrew translator? Why did he need to take one with him? All of these things are explored in the novel. There's some very interesting things about Columbus that are becoming more and more probable that they're true.
And when you're looking to write a book and you're looking at the historical aspect and the and not only just the great mysteries that go around, how do you, I mean, with all the things that are out there and all the history that's been doing, how do you pick, you know, which one exactly do you think that's going to fit within what you, you know, how you write and what you're trying to do? Kind of take people a little bit through the process of how you pick the stories that you decide to bring out.
Well, I try to find something from history that no one has dealt with before, because the last thing in the world we want to do is repeat or copy somebody. So I look for something that hasn't been dealt with. If it has been dealt with, I want to make sure that no one's ever dealt with it in the way I'm getting ready to deal with it. So I look for uniqueness. That's the number one thing. When I found this nonfiction book, which is referenced in the writer's note in the back of Columbus, The Columbus Affair, so the readers can go find it and read it if they want to. When I found this book one day and I started reading through it, I went, wow, there's a story in here. I think I can make a novel out of this concept. It's a pretty interesting idea. And when I come across stuff like that, And I realized that I can actually make a novel out of it. That's really cool. And then I put it on my shelf. I have a shelf that has, like, idea books.
Mm-hmm.
And they go on the shelf and they stay there. And then when I'm looking for the next novel, I start pulling the idea books off the shelf and seeing, well, can this one work? Will this one work? Will this one work? Well, this book, I sat on that idea shelf for 4 years until I pulled it off last year. And I said, yes, this can work. I can make a novel out of this. This is a really cool idea. It's fresh. It's different. It's interesting. And not only that, it could well be true. So this book is going to challenge everything you thought you knew about Columbus and about the discovery of the New World. Yes, he sailed here. Yes, he came here. But he may have come here for a reason completely different than what you think. And it's not a reason that I made up. It's a reason that could entirely be possible.
And, you know, when you decided to go ahead and pick the Columbus Affair, and you decided to pick Christopher Columbus, was this picked on the preference that you already knew that Cotton was not going to be a part of it? Because this, of course, you know, could definitely be, you know, Cotton could definitely be within this book. But did you pick that knowing that you're going to have to create, you know, the characters and everything from scratch and not be able to use Cotton to be able to solve this mystery?
Yes, when I got the idea for this book, I knew it was going to be a standalone. Yes, I knew that Cotton was going to take a year off. It was time for Cotton to take a little rest. We're seven.
Yeah, you beat the hell out of him.
He gets a lot of problems with him, and it's seven books in, and after seven books, you know, the readers, you have to be careful. You can't keep going and going. You got to kind of give a break a little bit. It also allows a way for new readers to discover me that might be a little put off by seven books in a series, even though you don't have to read a single Cop Malone book in order. They can be read however you please. It's still the fact that there's seven of them sometimes can turn readers off. So I wanted to do it. Plus, it was challenging. I got to do something different. I got to, you know, kind of challenge myself as a writer, and that's always good to do. So it was there was a lot of reasons to do it. I enjoyed creating it, and I might do, you know, like I said, I'd love to bring Tom back one day, and I might do that in about 3 years.
And I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with New York Times bestselling author Steve Barry. His website is steveberry.org. The latest book is The Columbus Affair, which is his fourth standalone, comes out on Tuesday. But, you know, you did give Cotton Malone fans something to at least gnaw on for a little bit, because this is the third time you've done this now with an ebook original called The Admiral's Mark.
Admiral's Mark.
It is a Cotton Malone adventure.
It is?
And that's one thing that you've been able to take great advantage of is this ebook thing by bringing out these little novellas. You got to be having a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, the short stories are designed to stimulate pre-sales of the novel. That's their function. They're like an advertisement that kind of pays for itself. And this is a really cool little short story. It takes place 8 years ago when Cotton still works for the Justice Department, and it involves Christopher Columbus and something from the Columbus Affair. Now, you don't have to read it first, or you don't have to read it at all, by the way. It's just, it's like those little scenes at the end of the movie when the credits are rolling. They just throw in these little extra scenes for, you know, that's what these are. They're there. But if you read the novel and you read the short story, you'll go, oh, I see. If you read the short story first, then read the novel, you'll go, oh, yeah, I see where that fits. But if you don't read the short story, it's fine. But it's a cool little Cotton Malone story that takes place in Haiti. And I enjoyed doing it. Yeah, it's 99 cents. It gives the readers a chance to kind of discover me and see if they like me. But, you know, they don't have to pay, you know, $12.99 for an e-book or, you know, $26 for a hardcover. They can try me out for 99 cents. And as I said, it's like an ad that kind of pays for itself, and it's really designed to stimulate pre-ordering of the book.
And the one thing also that people can do, because like we were just mentioning off the air, I think that this is one of your longest tours that I can ever remember you doing. You created the nonprofit organization History Matters, which is, you know, you go along and you talk when you're at these workshops, and just to let people know that you're going to be on May 15th, you're going to be down in San Diego. You're going to be doing something at the Martin House and Gardens in San Diego with the History Matters event, along with Writers Workshop. Kind of explain how those kinds of things work so people can have an understanding when they go and they meet you, what they can expect.
Yeah, we're going to do some really cool stuff. All of this is on my website, steveberry.org. We're going to do several events in San Diego, a couple events in San Francisco, and they're going to be a meet and greet, which is going to be done where I'm going to speak and take questions and sign books. And all of the money raised there, I think there's a ticket price to come to that, will go to the local historic project that we're there to sponsor. Then I'm also going to be teaching a writer's workshop, both in San Diego and San Francisco, 4.5 hours, intense on the craft of writing. You're going to learn in 4 hours what I learned in 12 years. And it's a very intense workshop. I've taught it to 1,500 students so far around the country. All of them have seemed to really enjoy it. And we're doing two there, both of which are detailed on my website under the events section. I encourage all the writers out in San Diego, San Francisco to come out. And then we're going to be doing another one in Kansas City, and another one in Salt Lake City. So please check out the website and check those out.
Yeah, because there might not be, you know, some of the writers, but you're also going to be around, of course, Connecticut and D.C. later in the year. You're always going to be at Thriller Fest in Iowa, Florida, and like you said, Kansas City, Texas. So, you know, you're going to be, you know, kind of all over the place. Where do you, and of course, everybody wants to know, where do you find the time? Where do you find the time to sit and be able to write and be able to get these things out and kind of clear your head? Because, you know, like when you write, you have to kind of be a little focused and do what you're doing. You have so many things going on. How disciplined do you have to be able to do everything that you got going on?
You have to have an aspect of discipline. You have to also have good planning. So, yeah, we plan a year in advance. I knew a year ago that I would have from May 15th to about June 15th, I'm going to be pretty tied up. And we knew that, so that's simply factored into the writing schedule. Everything is planned a year in advance. We're planning next year's schedule right now. Right now, you know, 2012 schedule's done. We're looking at 2013
right
now. We're planning that, and that's worked around the writing. The writing is factored in first. The tour's factored in traveling second. Elizabeth and I travel at least once a month, sometimes two times a month, but at least once. We do an event around the country. And then when a book comes out, it's very intense and to do. So it's just a matter of planning and being organized and sticking to the plan.
And the one thing that you also have on your website, again, it's dbarry.org. You've got so many things on there. People can spend, you know, a couple hours just going through everything that you kind of have up there and going on to get to know you more. But the one thing that you also have on there is some podcasts. And, you know, you kind of talk different about different books and different things that you have going on. Are you going to have more things about the Columbus Affair as you go along tour? Are you going to have podcasts from the tour and load those things up and let people kind of know, you know, how you're going about, you know, forever? Because as you know today, you know, social media takes over so much of everybody's time, especially authors and marketing, that the more, I guess, you can just be more with the people and be out there, I you know, it helps.
Sure, we do all of that. All that will be done. We also have a Facebook fan page that we monitor and keep up every day. I have a lady who does that for me. I go on there every once in a while. While I'm on tour, I'll be posting reports of what's going out there on tour and some photographs and pictures. All that will be on my Facebook fan page. So if anybody out there, you know, go to there, you know, click on it, come aboard, and, you know, like us, and you'll be able to keep up with all of that through the Facebook page. I don't Twitter. I don't do that, but I do the Facebook page and I do my website, and we keep both of those up to date with the latest stuff.
Yeah, and that's the one thing that I guess, like you said, you know, 12 years, you know, learning 12 years the craft, and you've been doing this for quite some time, that you've seen how the changes have gone in publishing from when you first started until now, and that's got to be, you know, something that you're continually learning and you're continually finding out about different things and everything else. How's that kind of roller coaster been where, you know, before all the social media, you had to do the tour, you had to do the shows, you had to do the things because people, you know, they just couldn't go to the internet and just couldn't find out those things like they can now. But now it's changed in how you're getting with people. How's that experience been because it's just changed as an author?
It's not even close to being, it's like being, you know, in the Middle Ages and now we're in the modern ages. That's how much it's changed just in the last 6 years. When I first started out with the Amber Room, I had a web page. We all did. And I got about 50 to 75 visits a day where people came and hung around and visited and went from page to page and whatever. Today we get around 1,200 a day. 1,100 to 1,200 a day, which shows you the significant difference between there. So it's just a, it's completely changed. All the marketing, everything you do now is utterly different. When I first started out, the hardcover was supreme. Hardcover reigned supreme as the supreme format. Not anymore. E-book now reigns supreme. So, you know, it's a complete change. The paperback market, the mass market, was a very big deal, you know, 7-8 years ago. Now, not so much. It's still there, but it's dwindling as e-books begin to eat into that as well. You know, right now for my sales, 70% of my sales are e-books. 30%.
Oh, my God. 70%
are e-books, 30% are books, and that is typical for a writer in my genre. The writers in the thriller genre. Thrillers is one of the genres where e-books has really exploded, and so it comes out about 70-30 is what it cranks out to when it's all over and done with, and that shows you the difference. That's why print runs are down. That's why you don't see as many books printed anymore, because more people are buying their information and their books in an e-format. Now, the book's not going anywhere. It's just getting less of them is all.
Right, and that's the one thing that I try to tell people, because they say, oh, I don't like e-readers. I'm just going to reprint. And I'm like, well, that's fine, because it's never going to go away. They're never, ever going to go away. But with someone, you know, what this has been able to do also is it gives the ability to someone maybe in, you know, different countries and everything else with the Amazon explosion and Barnes & Noble, they can get their own Kindle. They can buy it right away instead of having to wait for, you know, the book to come and maybe have all these different, you know, international rights to show up in their bookstore. Now it just explodes out all over the place. Really
it does.
Fast.
As long as there's one little catch to that, though. You cannot download from Amazon unless you have a Kindle registered with a United States address. If it doesn't, if it's not registered here with a IP address and a email account that's registered here in this country, unfortunately, you can't download Amazon books outside of this jurisdiction. That's changing, but there are laws that are in effect. So the e-revolution's evolving, and it hasn't gotten to the global pace quite like that yet.
But speaking of global pace, you though did something again, you know, with the USO tour that you were able to go out with the military and you went over and you talked with them. And, you know, that's something that I don't know if you're going to be doing in the future, but you also mentioned just how it is great to hear from those people because, you know, you're hearing firsthand, you know, just right in front of you and just seeing how your work and the thriller works of, you know, your colleagues affect, you know, the people out there to give them, you know, that sense of entertainment when they're in this stricken, you know, terrible area.
I enjoyed doing it. It was a great honor to be asked. We did it in the fall of 2010. We were the first group of thriller writers to be sent over there in what's called Operation Thriller. It was a big success because they did Operation Thriller 2, and this year they're going to do Operation Thriller 3. So it's catching on and do it. We were sort of the experiment to see if it would work, and it did. I was honored to be asked. If they ever asked me again, I'd be the first one to jump on board.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Steve, I know that you have a busy time, and I want to thank you again so much for coming on. It is always a pleasure to have you. It's always wonderful to see when your books come out. And you know what? Like I said before, everybody, the Columbus Affair, Tom Sagan gives Cop Malone a run for his money here. You're going to definitely have to bring Tom back because you're going to have a lot of new fans who are going to be sitting there going, okay, now when you're bringing Tom back, and you know what? Not that I've ever heard anything, but you never know. Maybe Tom and Cotton, maybe they intermingle. Maybe you just see a snippet. Maybe he sees him passing on the road. You just never know what's going to happen. But coming from your mind, I know it's going to be exciting, and I want to thank you.
Thank you for having me. You never know. You might see him. You might see him together one day.
Seeing each other in a cab or passing in a cab. Ooh, you just never know. You can see the wheels churning already right now. I know
it. I do. And be sure to tell my good friend Paul Comprecos I said hello.
I will do that. Thank you so much. You have a good one, Steve.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. Again, everybody, that was New York Times bestselling author Steve Barry. His website is steveberry.org. The latest book, which comes out Tuesday, is not a Cotton Malone book. It's a standalone, his fourth in the series called The Columbus Affair with a new character called Tom Sagan, very complex character. You're going to love him. You're going to love the story. Steve is the one that does the great jobs in bringing, like he said, those events and those historical parts that haven't probably been done, like his last book, The Jefferson Key, which was Cotton Malone's first time in the United States with his adventure. But Cotton's going to be back. He wrote the Admiral's Mark. Steve is one of those authors that, you know, every author strives to be just because he's out in your face. He's there. He's talking. He's always available. He's always been so gracious to come and talk with us, to be able to let us know what's going on and everything. And it's just, you know, it's one of those things. You have to have him on your shelf if you're a thriller writer in the, or a thriller reader in the genre. And if you're an author, he's definitely a mentor that you can follow over and you'll never go wrong. We highly recommend all Steve Barry's books. There's not one in there that you would not enjoy reading. And it's summertime. Your e-reader, I know, can hold them all. All right? Can hold all 11 books and the 3 originals. So make sure you go out and get. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to be back on here with our next guest. Like we said, Nick Santora. You can find him at nicksantora.com. And his latest book is called 15 Digits. He is also probably more well-known, like you know, from the TV part, where he's been behind the scenes as he's written for The Sopranos, Prison Break, Law & Order, The Guardian, and he is the show creator, the co-creator of the show The Breakout Kings, which is on A&E, along with various other films. And his book, 15 Digits, is one of those fast-paced books that you just can't put down. And it brings, you just have to see, I'm gonna let him talk about it because I don't want to, you know, I don't want to spoil whatever he doesn't want to say. But while you're waiting, you can go on nicksantora.com right now and you can watch the clip of the book. What it is that he did a Hollywood trailer for his book where I do make a cameo, but I'm not going to show tell you who I am. And you can sit there and watch the trailer. It is a scene from the book, kind of with the prologue, and then brings itself back up in another chapter. So you have the sense you'll be able to kind of know. It stars Jimmy Simpson, which you'll know from Breakout Kings and a bunch of other things. It's about 7 minutes long, so you can go there now, nicksantora.com, and watch the clip to get an idea of the book, and then come back and listen to Nick talk about it. And we will be back here in a couple minutes. So in the meantime, here's something for you to listen to. welcome back, everybody, and I want to thank again Steve Barry for joining us and his book, The Columbus Affair, out on Tuesday. Now I want to move on here to our next guest, very special guest of ours, friend of ours here, that just came out, like I said, with his latest book, 15 Digits. Hopefully, during the music, you're able to go over to his website, nicksantora.com, watch the video, like I said, that starred Jimmy Simpson of the Hollywood trailer of part of his book, 15 Digits. And so we want to welcome Nick right now to the show. Nick, how you doing? Thanks so much for coming on.
I'm doing great, and I have to start off with a correction, because it doesn't just star Jimmy Simpson, it stars you and your wife.
Well, yeah, I told people that I was kind of in it, but I wasn't telling them where I was.
Well, I bet them, it'll be like Where's Waldo? They can find you, but you guys were incredibly helpful, and I appreciate you being part of it.
So, here we go. A lot of people know you, of course, from your work on Prison Break, The Sopranos, Law & Order. You're the co-creator of the show The Breakout Kings, which is very, very successful here coming out. And you decided way back when, I think it was about 6 years ago, to write a book called Slip and Fall, and you had so much damn fun doing that, you then decided that you were going to write this latest book, 15 Digits, which is an incredible plot of the story when people get into it, because, you know, you have those five people having to come together from totally different kind of backgrounds and having to now work together in order to reach, some sort of a goal, I guess you want to say. How long in the making was 15 Digits that you decide, hey, you know what, this is a great idea, and you had five incredibly great characters that you kind of put together and had to wrap them all into one? Not an easy feat to do, I might add.
No, first of all, I'm glad you find them to be great characters and interesting characters. Thank you for that compliment. So were you asking how did I get, how long did it take in making this, or why did I decide to wrap these five characters?
Was there something that kind of spurred, because, you know, it's very, when you're a thriller kind of suspense writer, of course, a lot of the readers are used to, like, you have the, you know, you have the one hero with a couple side characters, and you have the villain and some other people. But you did, I mean, it's a daunting task to have five main guys kind of in the book having to kind of all kind of work together, where, you know, you do an incredible job of keeping it all together, where a lot of authors can have that fall apart really fast, really quick, and just lose the whole thing. But you were able to keep that together and kind of wanting, you know, the people to know that. How did you kind of make that all work in the book?
Oh, okay. Yeah, absolutely. The whole reason for doing that, I guess, one is my television training lends itself to that. On Prison Break, I mean, people talk about the Fox River Eight. Those were the eight convicts that broke out of Fox River Penitentiary, and we had to be able to write all eight of those characters. And after a while, you kind of really exercise that muscle and become, adept at it. And the same thing with Breakout Kings. We had a team of six Breakout Kings, and we had to really learn how to write all their separate voices and keep all of them interesting and integral to the task at hand and whatever the plot of that particular episode or story arc is, if the arc goes over a few episodes. And so when I was writing the book, I didn't really find that challenging to keep all five people involved in the story and keep them interesting for the reader, because it's something I do in TV a lot. My first book, I basically had one guy, Rob Principi, was the character that really drove that story. I wanted to do something with 15 Digits. I love heist stories. I have a team of guys trying to pull off that heist. Those are always fun. And this isn't really a heist. It's more of a crime, but there's a heist aspect to it. But it's these five guys doing it. And it was a lot of fun to write those different voices.
Yeah, I mean, I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Nick Santora. NickSantora.com, S-A-N-T-O-R-A is the website. The book is 15 Digits, but don't forget about Slip and Fall, which is one that he wrote back when. And so this is his second book. But 15 Digits here is relation. People are going to say, what does 15 Digits mean? And it's basically 15 Digits is the account number where all five guys have three numbers. So they're missing the other 12. So that's the aspect that the reader needs to understand, is that they all five have to work together in order for them to get the money that they're heisting, I guess you want to say. And that's the dynamic of the emotional part of how the book kind of works together and how you had to write it, which is, like I said, one of those incredible feats that's not easily done. Believe me, I read thousands of books. It is so easy to make them fall off the edge, but you kept it all together, and that's the part that, you know, that the reader needs to understand.
Yeah, well, again, I mean, the compliment is so nice, and I'll take any compliment anyone ever wants to give me about my work. Yeah, the truth is, what you're saying is very smart, because there's these five guys, and they're all interwoven, because each of them have three numbers of this 15-digit account code, and they don't know each other's numbers. And what's smart about what you said is if I had allowed any of those guys to kind of fall to the wayside in the storytelling, it would have taken away from that tension of, hey, any one of these guys goes rogue, or if one of these guys gets hit by a bus on the way home, we're never going to get that money again. So even though I might be mad at this guy, I might hate this guy, I might not respect this guy, I might look down on this guy, we're a family to some extent. And mm-hmm. families can be dysfunctional. And this crime family, and I hate to say criminals, because they, yes, they're criminals, but they're good. Most of them are good people. They all have their reasons why they're doing it.
Right.
And that's something I like to write about. I really do love to write about ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances, because the you know, the superhero guy, I was going to say the James Bond kind of guy, but I'm not about to say anything negative about someone who sold 4 trillion books. But but James Bond, that was done well, but there have been people that tried to copy it since then, and it becomes a little boring because you said, this guy's flawless.
Right.
This guy never does anything wrong. This guy isn't really human. I like regular schmoes that get pulled into these super situations that require almost superhuman decision-making and ability, but they're not superhuman. And that's always fun to write.
And, you know, when you're thinking about your writing outside of your TV and the movies that you've been able to do, with your books, when you decided that you're going to start doing this, did you say, look, you know what, I'm going to do more standalones, or did you have kind of a series in mind that maybe you're still putting together? What did you kind of hope when you started to start writing that you really wanted to kind of convey yourself as an author different from yourself as a screenwriter?
If I can be honest with you, John, I just wanted to get published.
That's a goal, baby. That's still a goal.
That's my goal. And I really didn't think that far ahead. I wasn't smart enough to say, hey, I need to create a character that could create a series. Now, my first book, Slip and Fall, which, you know, became a national bestseller and sold really well, I got wonderful emails from people that said, I love this Principi character. Is he going to be in your next book? What's his next adventure?
Yeah.
And I love that character, too. And he might come back one day. You know, he might have another adventure and see what happens to this guy after how he barely disengaged himself from the New York or Brooklyn mafia and the FBI, and where is he now? And that he might come back to life in another book. Not that he was dead in my book. Might be dead
right.
in my book. I don't know. You got to buy and read the book. But he might come back to another book. But I never thought that far ahead. And it's surprising that I didn't have the brains to maybe make that decision and create a character who could become a series. Because in television, the word is series. It's a television series that I create or that I write. So I should have been smarter. But I've never been accused of being a very smart guy.
Well, I mean, if people have read your work now and seen what you've created, I would have to say that if they don't consider you a very smart guy, then they're a pretty stupid fan or reader, and, you know, I have no problem in saying that. But, you know, you, like I said, you did something different, and, you know, when you decide to do the trailer, we were on set, and we saw everything, and I'm going to tell everybody that if you think that making movies and TVs is glamorous, visit the set one time and understand how much work has to go into a 7-minute shot that you did. And, I mean, this was a labor of love that, you know, that you had to go through. Now, when you're picking which part you wanted to do, why did you pick this scene? What will people understand when they watch your trailer on this scene that lends them to say that that's the part of the book that you wanted them to understand, video-wise, when they read it?
Well, the scene, for several reasons. First reason is it really highlights the two main characters of the book. There are five people involved in this crime, and all the characters are important. You get to know them all really well. And it's so funny. People that read the book, I hear from people, emails or people that I know, or people will stop me when I'm out and say, this was my favorite character, that was my favorite character. And it tickles me that everyone has a different favorite character, and there isn't one that really stands out as the breakaway favorite. That means I did my job and made them all fully fleshed people that readers could enjoy. But these two guys really are the fulcrum of the crime, and they're really the ones that got it kicked off. So that's one reason why I picked this scene. The other is that this scene is the scene where the scam, the crime, the caper is first proposed. It's the moment the snowball, a little harmless snowball in the form of a suggestion, is kicked over the side of the hill. And by the end of the book, it's an avalanche and it's taking people down. So you want to see when that first little drop of snow starts rolling. I think that's always interesting to see the beginning of a chain reaction. And the third reason is it was production friendly. It's two guys in a bar, and I was able to find a bar that would let me shoot it. So that was the third reason. But I will say, and I'm glad you saw how hard it is to make film, because my friends back home in New York, you know, they call me up all the time, and they're like, how's the glamour of La La Land? How's the glamour of Hollywood? And I'm like, bro, I was up 22 hours yesterday on set eating unhealthy food. I put on 40 pounds in 3 years. I look like hell, and I'm exhausted. There's no glamour here. And no. And I'm glad that you saw it, what it is. And I want to say that film, if people go and watch that short film, that scene from the book, all the credit for that really goes to Malcolm Goodwin, who's an actor on Breakout Kings. He plays the character Shay on Breakout Kings. He's been an American gangster. He was in Leatherheads. He's one of the best and most underrated American actors in the country. He's phenomenal. And he produced that for me, and he got a crew together in 24 hours, and I'm just so appreciative that he was able to help me make that to show people this book can be a film, and this is a book you should take a look at. So, yeah, it was a great experience.
And I'll remind everybody, too, when Nick talks about the five people, the character in there, Jimmy Simpson, when he talks about it, he mentions the other three as the Puerto Rican guy, the black guy, and that other guy. So those are the other three that you're going to know about. So when you watch the clip and you kind of hear that, you know, that line coming out, those are the other three that are going to be, you know, that Gino, the other character that's in the that's his actor, that's his real name. That when you're
Rich
in there,
is the character's name.
Yeah, Rich. But you're going to understand exactly kind of how all that forms. Now, and again, you know, NickSantora.com is the website. The book is 15 digits. It's available now in all formats. And any freaking place you can go buy it, it's there, so there's no excuse for you. The other thing, and for the people who watch, you know, the show The Breakout Kings or still watch Prison Break and this and that, how would you, like, kind of let them know when they email you and they say, hey, you know, what is this kind of book? And does it, you know, don't you think that the fans that love those kinds of shows should fall in love with this? Because this is what you know, and this is what you've written about, and this is what's made you very successful. So there should be no reason, just because it's not on video and it's in writing, that they shouldn't go get this, because they're going to enjoy it just the same as your other works.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, if you like the kind of television that I make, Sopranos, you know, I wrote a Sopranos or Law and Order, or The Guardian was a show I did on CBS years ago, or Prison Break or Breakout Kings. I did Lie to Me for a little bit. That's what I write. I write crime that revolves around character. The crime is not the star of my stories. Look at one of the most famous films of all time, The Bicycle Thief. Well, what's the crime in that? You're stealing a bicycle that's worth about $3. But why is that beautiful little black and white film so famous? Because it's about the character, it's about the story, and why people do what they do, and why normal, good people decide we're going to take Wall Street down. And that's what's really, really fun about writing the story. So if you like Prison Break and Breakout Kings and Law and Order, I think you're going to love this book. I put my heart and soul into it. I hope people enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that that's the part that, you know, when you're portraying. The other thing is what's kind of difficult for you is you've always been kind of behind the scenes, behind the camera, just writing and doing it. But now as an author, it's kind of welcome to my world. And our world is that, you know what, you have to be out in front. You have to do the interviews. You got to do the talking. You got to talk to the people. You got to be engaging because they're not only buying your story, but they're buying you as an author, and they need to feel comfortable. How's that transition been? Because I know that it's not video and you're not in front of the screen, but now you have to put yourself out there as the person to say, I did it, I created it, here's my work solely right here in front of you. No actors doing anything. This is all me. How do you feel about having to do that?
It's uncomfortable, if I'm going to be honest. I mean, this is easy. Talking to you is easy. You're a really nice guy. We've met a couple of times now. Your wife's a sweetheart, and it's easy doing this. I've done some TV. I've done some film. I think I'm going to do the a big morning show here in Los Angeles soon on KTLA, and I've done some other stuff. That's a little bit more uncomfortable for me. I can go out there and do it and speak like this and probably look like I'm comfortable and having a good time. But the truth is I have got a face made for radio. Go to my website. I have a big, gigantic bald head. It looks like a bowling ball with eyebrows. And I just don't belong in front of a camera. So it is different. It is a little weird for me. But the big thing is I'm asking people to spend their money. And TV is effectively free. Almost everyone has a TV in their home. The stuff that I do on network TV is free. The stuff that I do for cable, a lot of people have cable, so they don't have to spend any extra money to watch my shows. But when I say, please go buy my book, I'm asking you to drop $15. And, you know, it's tough out there right now. And people are, you know, saving every penny. And so I want to give people a product that they're not going to say, I wish I hadn't spent that $15. This read wasn't good. So I did everything I could to make sure I gave people a read that when they read it, they said, man, I got my money's worth. I would have paid an extra $15 for this book. That's how much I loved it. So it's a little awkward for me to ask people, can you throw $15 out there and give my book a chance? But I have to. I mean, listen, making up stories and selling them is how I feed my family, and it's how I get money for the college fund. I think a lot of people have a misconception that if you work in L.A. and you're making TV, you're making millions of dollars every year. If you're a famous star, you are. If you're a famous star, if you're a famous actor, you are. If you created Mad Men or The Sopranos, you are. I'm a yeoman writer. I punch the clock. So I've got to ask people to buy my book, and I've got to do these things, which, again, I love doing. I love talking to people like you. You're great to talk to. You love, because it's obvious you love books. It's obvious you love the written word. It's obvious you love great characters. And I love talking to people like that because I love it too. But there is a strangeness, if I'm being honest, about asking people, do you mind digging into your pocket and throwing a saw buck and a half down and pick up my book? But I have to do it. So while I'm on the phone with you, or while I'm on the radio with you, hey, everyone, could you please throw it down a saw buck and a half and check out my book?
Yeah, I know. But, you know, I have no problem in telling people because that's why we're here. We're here to find, I mean, you're almost, when you're talking about, you know, we would have never kind of found you. It was like, you know, your publicist found us because we get about 3,000 books a year and we just can't review them all. We tell everybody we just can't review them all. But when we find something that we see that we know is, you know, that is worth getting behind, like your book, 15 Digits, that's what makes our job that much easier with a great author like you, with a great product like you put out in 15 Digits. And you know what? It's well worth, you know, the $15 or whatever it costs. I mean, it's well worth people to go out and get that because the entertainment that you've been able to create in that is something that people are going to want, and they're going to get the other one, and then they're going to start bugging you, and they're going to start emailing you, and they're going to say, if you wait 5 freaking years again for your next one, then they're going to be pissed. So they're going to want to see something every single year. So the more, your success is going to haunt you because now you're going to have to write TV shows, and now you're going to have to tell your wife, honey, look, I got to work till 3 a.m. because I got to get this damn book out because these fans won't leave me alone. How are you going to handle that one?
That would be such a high class problem to have. You will not hear me complaining. I pray that people like this book so much that there's a clamoring for another one for me. I love writing books. My biggest fear is that, you know, I put books out there that don't sell for whatever reason, and then I don't have an opportunity to write another one. I was very lucky with Slip and Fall. Slip and Fall sold like crazy, and people really enjoyed it. The 15 Digits is brand new. It's just out, so hopefully that sells well as well. It's doing absolutely fine, but, you know, you always want to have more and more people buying your book. If it gets to the place where, you know, my books aren't selling, I can't write books anymore, yeah, I would be crushed, because it's a different type of writing from TV and film. It's the purest expression of how I write getting to my readers. Viewers don't always get the purest expression of what I'm writing, because you have a million things that factor in. You have budgetary constraints. You have weather that affects, we can't shoot that scene today. Okay, well, can we shoot it tomorrow? No, but we can't shoot it today because it's raining, and we can't shoot it tomorrow because we don't have the time. You have to cut that scene. So I can take that beautiful scene that was supposed to take place on the docks or whatever, or blah, 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 and now it's going to be stuck in a conference room? And it just, yeah. You know, your art does get compromised by things that are out of your control. But with books, I just sit down and write for the reader. I write it for myself, in the sense of this is where my heart's taking me story-wise. I write it for the reader in the sense that I'm writing this for you in the hopes that you enjoy it. And if I didn't have the opportunity to do that a third time, you know, if it didn't sell well, I would be crushed. So I hope that what you're saying comes to fruition and people love this book and there's a clamor for another book, because I would love nothing better than for Little Brown to say, hey, Nick, let's get that next book out.
And you know what? You're also doing something and when people go to your website, nicksantora.com, S-A-N-T-O-R-A, they're going to find a contest that not every author, in fact, probably no authors can really do. And that's and they better hustle their ass right now, because they have until May 15th to get this done, which is they can win a trip to visit you and Adam Carolla on the making of a movie. Now, it's a comedy movie, but they'll be able to visit the set and a bunch of other stuff you got going on. And I will disclaim it to say this is Hollywood. Even though things look promising, you know, I know, things get screwed up and things might not happen, but you still have consolation on there. But tell everybody a little bit about that, that you put together for the, for this prize that you're having out there.
Well, it's funny. The great and brilliant Adam Carolla, who's one of the funniest comedians out there and has the number one podcast, according to the Guinness Book of World Records right now, he and I have this movie that we have recently set up. We were trying to get the deal done, but offers have been made for this movie. So now it's with the business affairs and legal guys, and they're hammering out the details. But basically, Adam has this bit that he does on his podcast called Hypothetical Road Trip, where he gives you two different people. One will be a hardcore sports enthusiast, and the other person will be, you know, a guy who only wants to listen to Aerosmith, and he has to sing along at the top of his lungs. Would you rather drive cross country with the guy who's talking about how you can blast your glutes the entire trip, or a guy who's singing Aerosmith at the top of his lungs and do a hypothetical road trip across the country? And you give your reasons why. Basically, I incorporated that into this contest. It's no purchase necessary. You can borrow a book from a friend. You can get it from the library. Ideally, I would love for you to buy it, being honest.
Just go buy the damn book, people. Come on, don't be cheap.
but you read the book, and of those five main characters, just send me an email through my website and rank them 1 to 5 of who you most likely to least likely want to go on a hypothetical road trip with, and explain why. And just make it funny. And then I'll just, you know, read them and pick the one that works the best. Some people have been sending me one sentences for each one, and they're funny. Others have been sending giant paragraphs for each one. Don't kill yourself. Just make it quick and funny. And the winner, I'll fly out. Personally, I'll pay for the airfare. It's continental United States only. You have to be a U.S. resident. And I'll pay for your airfare to wherever we're shooting, and you spend the day on set and just watch filming, and it's a really interesting, fun experience, I think, being on set. And then fly you back, that night or the next day. And it could be a fun thing to experience. So that's basically the contest. But it's got to be in by midnight the 15th.
And I will let the people, the winner, know that if you do win, make sure that you don't eat till you get to the set, because you're going to have a lot of donuts and a lot of bagels and a lot of stuff like that, and you're going to need to exercise, because like Nick said, it ain't the you're not going to have organic vegetables. All right, let's put it that way. It's a lot of finger food, a lot of stuff that goes on.
No, craft service has destroyed my health, and I try so hard to eat healthy, but man, the food on set is not good for you. And
when your wife makes those brownies, that's not easy either, because she makes fabulous brownies.
Yeah, thank you. My wife made a little something for when we were filming that short for the crew. I just wanted to add one thing about the contest. It looks like this might happen. It could be a year until we film this thing, or it might never happen. And if that happens, there's consolation prize. I'll send you some autograph stuff or whatever. But I want this movie to happen, and I hope it happens. So, you know, we're keeping our fingers crossed. It looks promising.
Yeah. Well, Nick, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure. And, you know, we're waiting to now. You know, now you got the pressure on you. So guess what? You know, next May, we want to be talking again, because you're going to have your third book out. And so we're going to be talking to you on that point. And anything else you got going on or whatnot, of course, you know, you're always welcome to let us know. And, you know, we'd love to have you back on. So enjoy yourself. Have a great one. And you take it easy.
No, thank you so much. My best to your wife. Thanks for having me on your great show. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Nick. Enjoy. Have a good day, and we'll talk with you soon.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Again, everybody, that is author Nick Santora, Santora.com. The book is 15 digits. Go get it, because you got till May 15th if you want to be able to go on set with Adam Carolla and Nick on a show, you know, right there, along with, not only are you able to have a prize, but you're able to get great entertainment from a fascinating book. I can't tell you how fascinating that the concept of the book is that he wrote, and to be able to go out and get it, I highly recommend. 5 stars. You won't be able to put it down. In fact, you'll email me and be pissed, because you would have stayed up till 5 a.m. just to be able to finish the thing. So go out and get it. Nick Santora, 15 digits. We're going to take about a 2-minute break. We're going to be right back with our last guest of the day, Paul Kempercoast, who was a co-author with Clive Cussler on many of the Numa files. He's also going to talk about, though, his original books that he created, and now they're coming back into ebook form. Paul is coming now into the 21st century, so we're going to have him on. So until that time, here you go. we all, just another brick in the wall, everybody. And I want to welcome, again, Nick Santora and Steve Berry for joining us today. It's been fabulous. Make sure you go check them out, steveberry.org, nicksantora.com. Now we're going to rock it over to our last guest here of the show, Paul Kempercos, which I said was that he was one of the co-writers, you know, with Clive Cussler on the Pneumophile series, written some books there, but he also has his own work that he's coming out, which is now going to be in ebook form. The first one, Cold Blue Tomb, is already hit. And so, Paul, how you doing? We want to thank you so much for coming on.
I'm doing fine. Good morning, or good afternoon for here on Cape Cod.
That's right. You're out there on Cape Cod.
Thanks for asking me to come aboard this morning.
Yeah, because a lot of people might recognize your name, like I said, because you wrote with Clive Cussler on the Pneumophiles.
Yeah.
You wrote, I think it was 7 books with him on those?
Eight books. I like to say he wrote with me.
Yeah, he wrote with you.
He wrote with me, yeah.
But before go ahead.
I did 8 books with him, the 8 original Pneumophiles books with him. It was a new concept. There was a spin-off from the Direct Pit that they wanted to do. They wanted to get books out quicker, and he was getting a little slow, and they felt that they wanted to expand the franchise, the Pneumophiles franchise. So he got in touch with me, and I did them. I did 8 books, and they all did very well.
Yeah, I mean, and I was going to kind of ask, you know, kind of how that kind of thing worked with you getting with Clive, and then you also wrote another one with Simon Green, the man with the golden torque. People might know Simon Green, of course, and it was kind of a Pneumophile, and it was kind of mixed in there. But your other series back, or not really a series, but your other book, and you have your first one here, Cool Blue Tomb, which is now in ebook form. And like I said, so you've kind of made yourself go into the 21st century.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, how has that been able to, you know, how is all this transition happening from, you know, coming and now making your work available in ebook form and kind of re-bringing these books back out? And then I know you're working on a new one and everything else. How are your fans kind of be able to relate those Pneumophiles with your other work that was actually done, like I said, before you wrote with Clive?
Well, I feel as if I've come full circle because there's a link between what I did before and the Pneumophiles, and then me coming back to this. I like to tell people that I got into writing fiction because of the bad navigation of a 18th century pirate. I worked for a newspaper on Cape Cod, and the reporter, there was pirate ship, supposedly a treasure ship, that went aground off the Cape, and the reporter who was covering the story left, and I took over the story. And there were 3 groups that were trying to, they were fighting to get the control of the ship, and I thought it would make a nice nonfiction book. It didn't get anywhere, so I thought, oh, what the heck, maybe I could make a detective private eye novel out of it. And I came up with a character, Aristotle Socarides, in part because of Greek-American background, and I thought Cape Cod would be kind of a nifty place to set a mystery. It's got the fogs and the lonely beaches, and it's an area that's been under transition from the very old to the new. So I wrote it, and I got a 2-book contract with Bantam, Double Day, Dell, and Cool Blue Tomb was the first book. It, much to my surprise, won a Seamus Award for Best Original Paperback when I wrote it. Sue Grafton was the one who announced it. It really pleased me as a fledgling writer. And it kind of follows a group. It centers on a treasure ship, not a pirate ship, but a treasure ship off Cape Cod, and a diver who has some very important papers leading to that ship is found dead, and the skipper of the ship hires a detective. Jumping ahead to the Cussler stuff, I did 5 more books in that series. Then there was kind of a break, and Clive called me up one day and gave me the pitch. He said that they were doing this new series, and would I like to do it? And it was going to be a spinoff of the of his very successful Dirk Pitch series. And the guy they came up with, who would be sort of the equivalent of Dirk Pitt, was Kurt Austin. And so we created that team approach, and we did 8 books, and they were all bestsellers. But getting back to Socarides' book, when I was starting to write with Clive, I was having a little trouble getting a handle on a new character. And he said, just write Sock. He said that the series was sold on the basis of what I had done before with my Cape Cod Private Eye, and they liked the characteristics that he brought to it. So when Kurt Austin came out, he had some of the characteristics that went with Sock, and Clive came up with the idea of, there are other similarities too, Clive came up with the idea that he would live on a boathouse on the Potomac. Well, my original detective lived on an old boathouse on a bay on Cape Cod, and he came up with the idea that Kurt Austin would have a love of philosophy, and my original character had had studied Greek philosophy in college, so there was it was kind of an overlap. I did the book, and then I was sitting around trying to, also working on a new book on my own, which would continue the team approach I used with the pneumophiles, when I realized the stuff that I'd written before was just sitting around gathering dust, and I thought, what the heck, why don't get into the 21st century, and maybe there's a whole new readership out there. So that's how I found you guys, and I'm very happy I did.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people always wonder, especially when, like yourself, that you're kind of writing, and a lot of, and you didn't reach, you know, bestseller New York Times status, and a guy like Clive Cussler comes knock on your door and realizes the talent that you have and is basically saying, hey, you know what, I want to do something new and I want you to do it. And the dynamic that you're able to kind of fall into that is very fascinating. And I guess a lot of people just love to know, like, what's it like, you know, while you're working with somebody like that. Like you said, a lot of it is, you know, him writing with you instead of kind of vice versa, even though I guess his name's higher on the marquee. You know, well, how does all that kind of dynamic work, and how do you bring your own original stuff into, you know, what you're trying to do?
At the time, there weren't very many other writers collaborating in fiction. Tom Clancy had come out with a series called Op Center, so it was kind of experimental for us, and it was kind of he kidded me for the longest time with a who would have thought I was writing these first person regional mysteries, and once I made the big jump into the international multi settings, and it wasn't without difficulty. When I first wrote the book, it went well for a while. Serpent was the first book. Then it didn't do so. My writing didn't go well after that. So he liked the first 30 pages, but not the next 100. So I hopped a plane and went out to see him. He lives in Scottsdale. And we sat around, and that's mostly what we did. We sat around, and I was pretty nervous about the whole thing, and he likes to tell stories, so we'd be sitting in his office telling stories, and I was there with my yellow notepad going, I got to write a book. I got to get this thing out. I have no idea what I'm doing. But then he would come back. It was kind of a way of, it was a weird way. We'd be sitting in the office, and we'd talk about character or plot, and we were kind of on the same wavelengths, which helped. And he would just have a question, and he would come up with an answer. He said, well, you know, you could do this with a bad guy, or you could do this with the good guy, or you could set this. So it was like, even though I was writing the books, it was really a true collaboration. I would get in trouble about halfway through and then get on a plane and fly out to see him. We'd go over the stuff, and I'd come home, and I'd write the book. So that's how it worked with us. Other people might work differently.
But the one thing that also is, you know, you don't only just have, you know, Cool Blue Tomb. You have, you know, several other works, which I know, you know, Neptune Eye and a couple others. What, when you're looking for new readers and people trying to find you, how would you kind of explain, you know, like, because they were back in 1991, so we're talking about 21 years later now that they're finally coming back in ebook form, and they're probably out of print, people trying to find those. How would you kind of explain yourself as an author outside of the whole Clive cluster, just you, just Paul Kempercoast? How would you do that?
Well, first of all, I hadn't read these books in the longest time, and then now I'm going over them for proofreading, and I was struck by how dated they were in some aspects, that there were no cell phones commonly used. GPS was, you know, still a dream. They were still using a system called Loran. But I was struck by, number one, how I thought they were pretty good. And now that I look back at them, I think they're very good. In some respects, they're more literate than the formula stuff I was doing with Cussler, although we sold hundreds of thousands of those and not so many in my original book. And I thought, well, the verities are still there, that lust and jealousy and violence and envy and hatred and love, that those things are eternal. So even though some of the gadgetry may change, that these things give the story legs. And the other things I discovered was the timelessness of some of the themes. That the first book involved a controversy over a wreck, and all I have to do is pick up the paper, and you'll see stories about Odyssey, I think, going after treasure wrecks and getting into battles with governments about ownership. The second book, Neptune's Eye, was set in Woods Hole, which is world famous as a center of oceanographic study, and involves underwater robots and ROVs and AUVs, and they are very big now. It's gotten even bigger now, but the third book involves marine theme parks, which were a controversy having to do with that. I think maybe it was my newspaperman's background. I kind of look for controversy. Down the line is a book called The Mayflower Murder, and the theme is Indian casino gambling, and I can pick up the Boston Globe or the Cape Cod Times today, and they're still fighting over whether the Indians are going to have a casino in Massachusetts or who's going to get it, because it's the same thing as back then. There's big money involved, and there's emotion, and a little high-stakes thing. So those things don't change. So I think the books hold up pretty well, and I'm not usually one to toot my own horn. Usually it's the opposite.
Right.
Toot.
Everybody, and you know, and the one thing that, you know, of course, back in 1991, the Internet was not around. Facebook was not around. Social media was not around. None of that was around. But you do have a website. It's paulkempercoast.com, and that's KEMPRECOS. You have a lot of stuff that you now just, you know, you're starting to build it because it's something that's new, so you have to kind of build it. You have to kind of get it up there. And, you know, you just started to go ahead and, you know, get your Facebook page up and your fan page up and all of that stuff going together. When you look back in 1991 and now 2012, you got to kind of be shaking your head saying, I never thought that it would change this much so damn fast.
I never have. The publishing business has changed a lot in the 20 years or so I've been in it. The business itself, and the fact that there are no small publishing houses as there were before, and editors don't take a lot of time to work with you, and they're looking for the blockbuster. Interestingly, the book I've been working on, and I've got it with an agent now, hope to sell it, involves a it's kind of a combination of my old SOG books and the stuff I was doing with the Cussler. It's set partly in Woods Hole. It involves underwater robots. But it's also set on a world stage, and there's a treasure involved, and it takes in the international consideration. So it's kind of full, that's why I said it's kind of full circle for me. I did one thing, I did another, and now those two things are melding together, and I hope will be another series. We'll just have to see.
Yeah, I guess, you know, what, you know, since your, you know, your last, you know, your last book was quite some time ago, but you wrote a lot with Cussler, was mm-hmm. there something that you decided to go ahead and say, you know what, I want to write a new one. I want to get back into the game. I want to start, you know, doing something different. Was there something that clicked? Was it a character that came into your head? Was it the plot that came into your head first? You know, what was kind of that thing that, that got you the light bulb back on and your hand back on the paper?
I wanted to write another book on my own, and I didn't want to go back into the private detective. I had written those at a certain time in my life. I wasn't quite sure whether I could hit the same chords with that character, so I decided to do something new. And because the Pneumophiles had been so successful, that I thought I would try and do something similar to that with a different hero and a different cast of characters. But I wanted to get away, and some of the readers who read the old Pneumophiles could probably see that I was straining sometimes. I wanted to build in more character than it was actually necessary, because I like character. I like to read it myself. Mm-hmm. And it worked very well. Pneumophiles developed a pretty good following, I think, precisely because the characters. So I wanted characters, first of all. So then I decided to do a theme, and it would have to do with a treasurer, and I'd always been fascinated by the character, the legendary character called Prester John. And I came up with an idea that there would be a treasure involved. But then I wanted to put in this high-tech stuff that I was familiar with, the underwater
right.
stuff that I've been writing about for the last 20 years or so. So I just kind of brought it around full circle. And as I say, it's kind of a combination of Pneumophiles and the old Socarides books.
And, you know, the one thing that I think that we were kind of surprised when we started reading was the amount of comedy, because, damn, you're just a funny guy when you're writing. And I think that that's one thing that people might not kind of get is the comedy that you have, you know, in your books. And was that something that you planned, like in Cool Blue Tomb and Neptune's Eye and your other work, you know, Death in Deep Water? Was that something that you planned? Were you looking for that kind of comedic aspect to kind of enter in there? Or just kind of just fall into place with the characters that you were writing?
Well, not at first. When I first sketched out the idea, I ran it by an agent in New York, and she liked it. But we were going back and forth on it. And previous to that, I had done a sketch involving a Greek-American character. It was kind of like a Saturday Night Live sketch. And I threw it in a drawer. And I said, at one point I said to her, I said, should I write something funny? Because I like comedy. I like to write funny stuff. It's difficult, but I like to do it, and she should give it a try. So I put that in the book, in the manuscript, and that's actually what sold it. And I go back to Raymond Chandler, who wrote the Philip Marlowe stuff, and if you read his stuff, and he and Dashiell Hammett were pioneers developing the American Private Eye novel, but it's Chandler's stuff can be very funny sometimes, in between all the violence and all the other bad stuff. There's some very funny stuff that happens, and I think I kind of wanted to impart that as well, and I think making the character less of a superhero, hard-boiled, making him human, I think makes it more appealing, and I was very pleased with the way it turned out.
Yeah, I guess that that's something that was kind of very unexpected, was that comedic approach that, you know, you don't, it's very difficult, you've done it so brilliantly, to be able to have comedy with thriller, because a lot of people think that it's more romance with thriller that kind of fits together, because to have comedy with thriller, people are like, oh, how can, you know, death be funny or things be funny? But it's how the characters just come off when just the one-liners or just the funny stuff. And then all the, you know, the detail and the things that you put in with the diving and with everything else. I mean, it's just a fascinating marriage, I guess you want to say, together with those two genres.
Well, one of the things that any editor looks for in a book from new author or other author is that thing called voice, and it's kind of, it's hard, very hard to define, but it's kind of a weird way that a character looks at the world, a slant that he has, that you can pick up a book by any author who's defined, who's got a strong voice, and you don't even have to see the name of the author. You'll say, oh, I know who this is. This is so-and-so, so-and-so, just by the voice. And that's what I tried to do with this character. He is he's a Vietnam War veteran. He's got issues with his family. He's had some bad stuff in his life, as well as good stuff. And the way he deals with a lot of this is with a sense of humor. But at the same time, he's very serious about things, and he thinks about things. But it's a kind of skewed way of looking at the world, and I make some different, and I think, as I said before, appealing as a character. I've had for years, people have come up to me, and even while I was doing the Kostra stuff, and said, when are you going to write another sock book? And I've very glibly said, well, I can't afford to, because I was doing well with the Kostra books. And the other thing was, as I said a minute ago, I'm not sure whether I could. Well, maybe I could, but I'm a different person than I was back then when I was doing it. So the new detective would, I assume, would have some of the similarities of the old and the new, because you do put a bit of yourself into the books. I'm not 6'1" with a thick head of hair and a mustache and muscles like this guy, but you do put some of the way you feel about things into the book.
And I think that you just made an interesting point, and real fast, is that, like you said, you've changed as a person. And so that's the one thing that I think that readers have to understand, too. You're just not a robot. You know, you're a person with emotions and everything else. And when you write, you want to put part of yourself into the story. And if, therefore, your ideas have changed or things like that have gotten different, then your books are going to be a little different because your voice has changed and it's not always going to be the same. And that's the fascinating part when you discover a new author and then you start reading his work, how your voice has changed over time. And it's just made it that much more complex and interesting for you as an author. And I think that that's the one thing that fans need to understand. This is not a cookie-cutter business. This is one that takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of emotion to get right.
Well, it's not necessarily a bad thing. Your voice changes.
No, it's not.
Even be a good thing. But then there's the logistical stuff, like if I wrote another book in that series, how old would he be? Would he have white hair? Would his black hair, dark brown hair go to white? What would have happened to other people in his life? Would he still be going out with the same woman? His cat would not be alive. Or would you, with the Kostra books with Dirk Pitt, he chose to age Dirk and concentrate the action in that series on Dirk's two children. But if you go to, I don't know, James Bond, I don't know whether he was aged or not, but some authors choose not to age their characters, others do. And when you do, it presents problems, because if you're writing a character who's close to life, it's just like, you know, you have parents, you have kids, you have pets, you have cars, everything changes, the world changes, so you have to change with it. So it would be, I've sketched out a few thoughts for another sock novel. I don't know if I'll ever get to it, but it presents some interesting challenges for a writer.
Right. Well, Paul, I want to thank you so much for coming on. We've simply run out of time here with this episode. And again, everybody, Paul Kemprecos, his website is paulkemprecos.com. His book, Cool Blue Tomb, it's new in ebook form. It's not newly written, but it's a new book in ebook form to bring out his series. Got some new stuff hopefully coming along the way. So, Paul, we want to thank you so much for joining us today. And we can't wait to see what you got coming in the future.
I agree, to me too. Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for all the help you've given me along the way.
Hey,
I hope people,
you're welcome.
I hope that this opens up our readership and that people enjoy the books as people have in the past. So thank you.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, a whole new generation now, 20 years gone. That's a lot of people that started off at zero age is now 20 still getting into books, and here we go.
I don't know if I have time, but I was going to – at a local bar where I used to hang out, and there was a cover of my first book was on the wall of the bar, and I started chatting with a the young waitress about how glad I was to see the cover. It's up in a frame with a lot of it's a very local bar. And I happened to mention that I wrote it in 1991, and she said, "Well, that's the year I was born." I said, "Shut up."
Oh, man.
So anyhow, a lot of readers out there looking for good stuff, and I think they would be pleased. Well, thanks
so
much.
All right, Paul, we are running down, so we will talk with you later, and enjoy yourself. And
okay,
thanks again. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. So again, everybody, that was Paul Kempercoast. PaulKempercoast.com. I want to also thank Steve Barry, SteveBarry.org, author of The Columbus Affair, which comes out on Tuesday. Go pick that up. And then we also want to thank our guest right before Paul, Nick Santora, and his book, 15 Digits, NickSantora.com. Go pick that up. There's no excuse. Go get it. It's summertime. Everything's going on. We will see you here next week with another fabulous show. We just keep bringing them out. So until that time, thank you everybody for joining us so much. Support all the readers, support all the authors and all the books, and just keep them writing. See you until next week, everybody. Bye.